Why are you frowning?
Just because I'm trying to like set up the screen, like just so that I can see you and the recording at the same time.
Okay, cool. Hello and welcome back to a podcast about murder. I'm Freya and I'm here with Jem as usual to talk about another true crime incident that you may be interested in. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I am okie dokie. That's not the context in which you use okie dokie.
That's okay. I think we should start using it in that context. I'm okie dokie. Okie dokie isn't a status. It's like a confirmation.
It's an acknowledgement of something.
Mm.
I hope everyone who is joining us for this episode is also doing okie dokie. And are you ready to talk about murder today?
I'm ready. I'm okie dokie.
Good, good. So today we're doing a case that, despite being one of the hugest murder cases, not only in the UK, but globally. Is hugest a word? Well, there's no little red squiggly line under it in my in my write-up. So despite being one of the hugest murder cases, not only in the UK, but globally this century so far, I actually know or knew very little about. I mean, I know a lot now because I researched it for the episode, but before doing that I didn't actually follow it at all. I was about 12 when this happened.
Yeah, so you weren't like following it in the news.
Yeah, it was 2007, which was a big year for high profile crime in media, because that was the year that Madeleine McCann went missing as well. So I do remember this case and Madeleine's case absolutely dominating news coverage at the time, but I wasn't really following it because I was 12. So, but as more and more comes out, and then the fallout from this case and the trial, actually trials, plural, just so much more comes from this that just sprawls out and becomes just a mad international phenomenon and a media circus that births a kind of celebrity in the weirdest way. So let's talk about Meredith Kircher and the multiple people who went up for her murder. Before I start, I'll just give a warning that this episode will include mention of sexual assault, although not incredibly specific or anything. You know, overall, that's going to come up. And also, when you're listening to this, you might find that if you know about this case, you might hear me say something and be like, I don't think it was exactly like that, or I've heard something slightly different to that. And I think it was really hard getting the story of this case down and making sure that what I had was, I could be as close to sure about as I could, because it was so, like, such a tabloid frenzy, the slight misinformation or not quite getting certain details exactly right in the media makes researching it really quite hard. So yeah, just bear that in mind. Like, there might be things that maybe I've even like picked up the wrong sequence of events or something like that. And I don't know, I tried my best. I'm going to start in a different way than I start most episodes. So instead of doing it in a more narrative way and starting by talking about someone's early life and going from there, I'm going to make it about a sort of timeline of events, starting from the discovery of the crime. And then we might be able to talk more in detail about those events afterwards. But I just think it's more helpful because a case like this can be so complicated, like I said. So it's the 2nd of November, 2007. In a villa in Perugia, Italy, the body of a 21-year-old woman is discovered lying under a duvet on the floor of her bedroom. As well as evidence of a violent encounter in the bedroom, a window in another room is found to be smashed and there is evidence of cleanup in the bathroom. Perugia is the vibrant and culturally rich capital city of Umbria, a region of central Italy. Perugia is known as the university's town as it contains multiple universities and art colleges where thousands of students flock to study from abroad. The young woman identified in the villa, Via della Pergola 7, is one of these, Meredith Kircher, a British student at the University of Leeds. She was on exchange and studying at the University of Perugia. She was studying European politics and Italian, as well as political theory and modern history. Meredith hoped to become a journalist or work for the European Union. Her friends called her Mez for short. Caring, funny, smart, and popular were all words used by Meredith's peers to describe her. I know that I said this was a timeline and not details as such, but I just wanted to take a moment to, like, humanize Meredith. Mm. And because, you know, she was a person and she had qualities and aspirations. And in telling the story of her death, I think it's important to recognize that first out. Mm. So on the 2nd of November, investigators announced the discovery of Meredith's body. I find the name Meredith a little hard to say, like, in fast.
It's hard to have a thus combination of sounds.
Yes, yeah, that's what it is, I think. But yeah, they announced the discovery of Meredith's body, saying that she was found partially undressed and the apparent cause of death was that her throat had been cut. Ooh. Forensic investigation and police inquiries begin. On November 5th, 3 days later, Meredith's housemate Amanda Knox, age 20, an American student also on exchange, is brought in for questioning. Upon returning home from staying with her new boyfriend Rafael Solicito, 23, it was Amanda who discovered the crime scene. Rafael, who was there and attempted to force Meredith's locked bedroom door open before police arrived, is also questioned. According to police, Amanda confesses that she was in the house when Meredith was murdered. Patrick Lumumba, the owner of a bar where Meredith worked, was also brought in after Amanda implicated him in the murder.
Hmm.
On November 20th, Patrick Lumumba had been jailed for a fortnight while police checked his alibi, which is a long time to be in jail when you technically haven't done anything wrong.
Yeah, when there's not definitive proof that you've done something.
Being in jail, like, a couple of days while they work out your alibi is one thing, but like a fortnight, 2 weeks in jail as an innocent person, that's a bit crazy to me.
What was his alibi that was so, like, hard to
I think he was saying he was working and they were just trying to figure out if enough people had seen him working at his bar.
That shouldn't take a fortnight to figure
out.
You
would think. I think this just seems a bit, slow. But yeah, it was about here when I was writing that I realised I'd been reading and typing Patrick Lumumba as Patrice Lumumba. And Patrice Lumumba is the Congolese independence leader who was the first prime minister of the Republic of Congo. It's just a name that I know in the back of my head. So I was just like, I got confused.
And he also runs a bar in Italy.
Exactly. So I was like, I know I've heard this name before. So I googled it and I thought, that's strange. He must have been named after him or something. But his name's actually Patrick. It's not Patrice. So I don't think it's probably irrelevant. So just to say, bar owner Patrick Lumumba is not to be confused with Congolese politician Patrice Lumumba.
I do get them confused all the time. So
whose assassination and replacement with a US-backed dictator to allow continued extraction of African resources by colonial powers is a subject that everyone should read more about when they have the time. But I digress. Patrick, not Patrice, had been jailed for a fortnight while police checked his alibi, as I said. On the 20th, he was released. Police had been able to verify that he had spoken extensively to a customer at his bar on the night of the murder, which accounted for his whereabouts. Of note, Patrick later won €40,000 in damages when he sued Amanda Knox for libel.
Hmm.
On November 22nd, media published a note written by Amanda in which she claims that her statements to the police have been given under duress. She says she was not given access to a lawyer or an interpreter. She writes, "In regards to this confession that I made last night, I want to make clear that I'm very doubtful of the verity of my statements because they were made under the pressures of stress, shock, and extreme exhaustion. Not only was I told I would be arrested and put in jail for 30 years, but I was also hit in the head when I didn't remember a fact correctly."
Hmm.
Meredith's autopsy is completed and shows 16 bruises and 7 cuts. Pathologist Luca Lally and the 3 other pathologists who review his work interpret Meredith's injury pattern as being consistent with her being restrained and sexually assaulted before her murder. On the 14th of December, more than 300 people mourn Meredith at her funeral at Croydon Minster, London. She is awarded her degree from the University of Leeds posthumously. Fingerprints found in blood at the scene, including a palm print on a pillow that was underneath Meredith's body, are a match to Rudy Gude. Guede?
How's it written?
G-U-E-D-E. I think it could be Guede.
Yeah.
But I feel I don't want to sound like an idiot, so I'm not going to say it again. I'm just going to call him Rudy.
Okay.
But he is a drifter with a history of break-ins and burglary. Rudy originally met Meredith and Amanda at their house in October. He had tagged along with some of the young men who lived in the downstairs portion of the villa one night. He is located in Germany in December and extradited to Italy, where he is confronted with the fact that his DNA has been matched to a sample taken from Meredith's body. He claims this was from a consensual sexual encounter and that he used the bathroom afterwards. And as he did so, another man entered and killed Meredith. He says that when he left the bathroom, he saw the man fleeing, and the man looked at him and said in Italian, "Found black man, found culprit, let's go." Unclear to whom he was saying, "Let's go."
Right.
So, I mean, Rudy's black, just to confirm that.
Okay, that makes it slightly less of an odd thing to say.
Yeah, so Rudy's implying that basically a white guy came in and killed her, and then saw him and was like, oh, there's a black guy here. They'll think he did it, so it's okay. And then ran away.
Oh, okay. So it's saying like he was framed, essentially, or that he just happened to be there.
And yeah, he's just saying he happened to be there. And because of racist reasons, that person was like, oh, lucky, you know, I can blame it on this guy.
Mm. How long was he in the bathroom for this all to happen?
It's basically Rudy took a shit in the bathroom. That's
right.
Like, so it could have been a while.
Okay.
You know, and that happened whether he was there to commit a crime or whether he was there for an innocent reason. That
right.
happened. He used the bathroom.
Okay.
On July 11th, 2008, Amanda Knox, Rudy, and Rafael Solicito are all charged with the murder of Meredith Kircher. On September 6th, and yes, you may have noticed how long that was taking, but that's the long, slow wheel of justice for you. Rudy requests a separate trial. His lawyer believes that the defense teams of Amanda and Raphael will come together to try and pin the blame on Rudy. So they feel that he'll get a fairer shot if he's on trial alone. Because even if you're all if you're all tried together as a group, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're all on the same side.
Right.
So if you
and you also don't all get the same sentence necessarily.
And you don't know, and you don't all have the same legal teams.
Right.
So just because you're on for the same crime, that doesn't mean you're like all necessarily mates or going to get together. In fact, in many cases, a lawyer's strategy would be, let's say that it was the others and not you.
And yeah, like we happen to be conveniently grouped with two other people who could, we could like really pin this on.
Exactly. On October 28th, Rudy is found guilty of murder and sentenced to 30 years, though this was reduced to 16 on appeal the following year. The main evidence against him is the fingerprints in blood at the scene, as well as his changing story and history as a criminal. And you can understand.
Yeah.
Fingerprints in the blood.
The fingerprints in blood really are hard to explain.
Very hard to explain. January 16th, 2009. The following year, is the beginning of Amanda and Raphael's trial. By now, the case is a media sensation. The trial is attended by journalists from around the world, and the courtroom is so packed that some journalists sit at the table with the defense team.
That doesn't seem like it should be allowed.
It's too much. DNA evidence is submitted that links Amanda's DNA to the alleged murder weapon, a knife found at the scene, and Raphael's DNA is found on Meredith's bra clasp. The theories for what happened focus around Amanda, Raphael, and Rudy wanting to involve Meredith in some kind of weird sex game. Amanda attacking Meredith, perhaps because of her resistance and perhaps motivated by underlying bitterness between the pair as roommates, and the incident ended in murder, according to this theory. It was even suggested that this could have been a sacrificial ritual and that it having occurred just days after Halloween was somehow significant.
Okay.
Amanda is painted as the ringleader. Raphael and Rudy are like under her thrall, if you will, and taking part in assisting in the attack, particularly the sexual elements, but they're doing so as directed by Amanda.
Mm.
It was Amanda, the prosecutors claim, who dealt the final wound that killed Meredith, the cut to the throat. And with Amanda's DNA as the only one on the knife, they really didn't have any choice but to argue that. They had to argue that she was the one who actually killed her because that's the only DNA that's found on this knife.
Right.
But obviously, this is a knife that's just in the house. Well, so there's so many reasons.
I was going to say it could just be a knife that they both happen to use because it's like they share a kitchen. But also, presumably, if someone else had handled it and even wiped it down after, then her DNA wouldn't have been found on it. Like, she has to have been the last one to hold it.
We're going to probably come back to some of these.
Okay.
These sort of strange inconsistencies in this story at some point later.
Okay.
The trial continues for months. On June 12th, the court hears testimony from Amanda Knox in which she describes being put under pressure to confess by investigators. She claims to have been verbally abused and physically hit, accusations that are denied by police, of course. Amanda says that the pressure and threatening of further physical violence, as well as being denied legal counsel, led her to admit to being in the house and to falsely name bar owner Patrick Lumumba as the murderer, noted that she never did admit to killing Meredith herself in this, like... So even when they forced a confession out of her, she named someone else
as a killer, just in the house at the time.
Responding to accusations that her demeanor after the murder was strange, Amanda says that she was in shock. She also despairs over the press handling of the case, contributing to her being perceived negatively. So what's happened at this point is the media has run with this story of a demented, possibly satanic sex game. And they've depicted Amanda, who, by the way, was only 20 years old. Mm. So she's only 22 during this trial, which is incredibly young. It's like, 20 to me now, looking back, is like almost like a kid.
Yeah.
You're just out of being a teenager, basically. They're portraying her as a cold, like, nymphomaniac, femme fatale type thing, like constantly drawing on her sexuality and how, like, she's got these men, like, doing stuff for her. And she's like, you know, she's like this cold sex demon, basically.
I was going to say, like, the construction of her as a figure that's like, you know, it's like a very stereotypical misogynistic image of a woman that's like able to manipulate men into committing crimes. And therefore she's the one who's responsible for it ultimately. And it's like, that just, I don't know.
it does
happen, I assume. Like, I'm not saying it doesn't, but like, it's sort of very rooted in old stereotypes about women.
Yeah. So an almost undeniably sexist wave of media frenzy completely ignores her male co-defendants and fixates on her looks, her sex life, her supposedly like hedonistic lifestyle, and so on. Mm. She is given the nickname Foxy Noxy.
Foxy Noxy?
Yeah, many people may have heard this. That was basically, you know, the kind of the Sun, the Daily Mail, if you know those outlets, type
classic
of nickname for her. So they'd be like...
Highbrow journalism.
Yes, exactly. On September 27th, the final witnesses are heard in the case and the closing arguments begin. Finally, on December 4th, 2009, over 2 years after the murder of Meredith, Amanda Knox and Rafael Solicito are found guilty on all counts. Rafael received 25 years and Amanda received 26 years. But that's not the end of the story. Amanda and Rafael both appeal their convictions. In December of 2010, Amanda appears in court to speak and claims both she and Rafael have been wrongly convicted. She says that the court made a huge mistake. In January 2011, forensic experts retest the key evidence in the case, the knife found at the scene and Meredith's bra clasp.
And it was Rafael's DNA that was on the bra clasp?
Yes.
Okay.
Meanwhile, police are fighting back against Amanda and her family's claims of mistreatment legally, following slander charges filed against Amanda for her claims of abuse by interrogators. Her parents are also taken to court for libel after the way they've spoken about the police when giving comment to the Sunday Times, a UK newspaper. So when she said that she'd been abused by the police were like, they sued her for saying that. And then when her parents said it, they sued them for saying that as
right.
well. So, you know, make of that what you will. On June 18th, 2011, two prison inmates are called to the stand and say that Amanda is innocent. However, each offers a completely different claim of what happened to Meredith, and the credibility of these witnesses is, of course, called into question. On June 27th, Rudy, the third suspect who's already been convicted, gives evidence in the appeal trial. He will not say that Amanda and Rafael were not involved in the murder. In fact, the prosecutor has obtained a letter in which Rudy apparently states Amanda and Rafael killed Meredith.
Right.
So he's going like, no, it was all you guys.
Right.
Of course, as the defense for Amanda and Raphael point out, this is just someone saying something. It's not based on
there's nothing.
Any evidence at all. And of course he's going to say, it wasn't me, it was you guys.
Yeah.
Before he basically heard who Amanda was, Rudy never said she was at the apartment. He just had this story of the other man that we already spoke about. So it's only later, when he realizes that these two are down for it, that he changes the story and says, yes, she was there and she was arguing with Meredith and I saw all this stuff. You know, that comes only after he realizes that there's a character called Amanda that he needs to basically implicate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a bit too convenient.
It is a bit convenient. However, you know, like some people, he might be trying to strengthen a story where like maybe the man that he saw was Raphael. And when Raphael said, let's go, he could have been talking to Amanda who Rudy didn't see. But now that he knows she was there, he might be trying to strengthen his story by saying he did see her. And so he's lying about the truth, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm just playing it, but like trying to set up how that could be something real. But yeah.
It does. Like, I'm not. Yeah. I can see that side of it, but it does also seem like telling a story and then someone having some information and being like, yeah, she was also there.
Yeah. Amanda states in court that the only time she, Raphael, and Rudy have ever been together in a room was in the courtroom. She reiterates that she has no idea what happened on the night of the murder. 2 days later, forensic experts return with their findings from the retest and cast doubt on the DNA evidence. Interestingly, it's not because they couldn't find Amanda's DNA on the knife. That was definitely there.
Mm.
It's that they can't say for certain that Meredith's DNA is on the knife.
Oh.
So there's doubt on whether this was even the murder weapon or if this was just a knife that was in the house. And Amanda's
DNA.
Why
would you assume, like, if it's not got, I just assumed it had her, like, blood on it.
You would assume that, wouldn't you? But their story was, like, it's been cleaned.
Right.
But, like, the only DNA you can find on it is Amanda's.
Mm.
That's just because she lives in this house and uses this knife.
Yeah.
In, you know, like, the defense can easily say that.
Yeah.
The prosecution is saying, well, yeah, the knife was obviously cleaned after the murder, so duh, like, yeah, there's no DNA. Mm. It's cleaned off. So, you know, make of that what you will, but, like, the only DNA on this is Amanda's. So if you're thinking about just legally constructing a case, we don't even have the murdered person's DNA on the murder weapon and the killer's together. Mm. So it's very, that's, the DNA evidence is starting to kind of break down at this point. Mm. To Raphael's DNA found on the clasp of Meredith's bra, the response is that this clasp was not collected until several weeks after the crime.
Right.
Which could have led to it being contaminated. Well, that's what the defense will say.
Mm.
And therefore, it shouldn't be considered reliable evidence just because it wasn't collected, you know.
Right.
One theory of how his DNA would have got there through contamination is because Raphael would have touched the handle of Meredith's door when he arrived at the scene with Amanda and tried to open it. And his DNA would have been transferred to the bra clasp when an investigator touched the door and then the bra clasp.
Right.
With the same gloves.
Okay.
So that's the defense's theory as to how this transfer could have happened. And if this clasp isn't collected properly, it can't be considered reliable.
Hmm. I don't know enough about how DNA works to weigh
to know if
that.
That's probable. I think it's like DNA transfer is so fickle, if that's the right word. Mm. Like, you know, you can touch things and your DNA might not be found even if it's there just because it's in such small quantities.
Yeah.
So a very small transfer like this is like 50, you know, it's a toss up whether it's going to be found or not.
It's not like swaying me one way or the other because I'm kind of like, I guess that could happen, but also it could be totally implausible.
It could be totally implausible, but like from a legal standpoint,
yeah,
the defense is just trying to throw doubt on the evidence. And this is like, this is one of very few pieces of physical evidence, and this is the only pieces of physical evidence that link Amanda and Raphael to this scene at all. So right. It's very important to the defense that they get thrown out. On July 25th, experts testify for the defense that forensic evidence gathered in the case was poorly handled and should be considered inadmissible. The back and forth continues. In September, Italian state police defends its gathering and processing of evidence and its DNA tests and points out that the defense never raised in the original trial any issues with the way evidence had been handled. The prosecution requests another round of DNA testing as well as to submit the records of the original testing to help disprove the accusation of mishandling. These requests are all denied by the judge. So the prosecution ends their argument by actually upping the ante and arguing to increase both defendants' sentences to life in prison. So this is the trial in which the defendants are claiming that they're completely innocent and they should be found innocent.
Right.
The prosecution is coming back and saying, no, not only are you not innocent, but you didn't get, we didn't give you enough years.
You know what? Fuck you.
Other parties in the case give statements, including Meredith's family and the lawyer of falsely accused Patrick Lumumba. Needless to say, Patrick isn't Amanda's biggest fan because of how she falsely accused him. So his lawyer accuses her of being two-faced and cold. Well, actually, what he said was that she had an angelic, good, compassionate side and a Lucifer-like, demonic, satanic side. So that's an extreme
statement.
This guy
should be writing, like, novels, not defending people in court.
Wrapping up their argument on September 27th, the defense denounces the salacious media portrayal of Amanda Knox and reiterates their argument that there is no solid evidence that can show Amanda or Raphael were involved in the killing. They argue that the heavy-handed interrogation of Amanda means her statements during questioning should not be held against her. Finally, on October 3rd, the jury agrees a verdict. They overturn the murder conviction handed to Amanda Knox and Raphael Solicito 2 years earlier. Although Amanda is found guilty of defaming bar owner Patrick Lumumba by telling police he was to blame, both she and Raphael are now free to go. She's ordered to pay, like I said, she's American, so it's $54,000 or like about 40,000 euros in damages to Patrick. Amanda Knox departs Italy for her home of Seattle as soon as she's freed. In February 2012, she signs a book deal with HarperCollins to share her story, but it's premature because the story isn't over. On March 26th of the following year, 2013, Amanda and Raphael prepare to defend their innocence for a third time, as the Italian Supreme Court rules there should be another trial. The retrial begins 6 months later on September 30th, 2013. Raphael Solicito has returned to Italy and takes the stand on November 6th, calling the evidence an illusion and dismissing the case against him as absurd. "I don't wish anybody on earth to go through what I went through," he says. Meanwhile, Amanda stays in the US and protests her innocence in written statements read in court by her lawyer in December. "I must repeat to you, I'm innocent," she writes. "I did not rape, I did not steal, I did not kill Meredith." The prosecution presents their evidence and arguments for a third time, their theory in which Amanda directs Raphael and Rudy to commit these crimes and then finishes the murder herself. This time, on January 30th, 2014, Amanda and Raphael once again find themselves convicted of murder. Raphael receives his original sentence of 25 years, but Amanda's is increased from 26 to 28 years. However, she has no plans to return to Italy.
Okay.
She appears in an interview with CNN in which she asserts, "I did not kill my friend. I had no reason to," and repeats that there is no evidence proving she was at the murder. Meanwhile, the appeals court reveals that it moved for a conviction mainly because they were convinced the third suspect, Rudy, didn't act alone. They believed Meredith's wounds showed there were multiple killers.
But, okay. Based on what, though?
I can't say because I'm not privy to the sort of forensic details.
Okay.
But I'm guessing that they're saying these wounds that are inflicted on her
aren't consistent with a single.
It just seems like there were multiple people there.
Right. Okay.
But I'm not sure exactly on the exact details that made them come to that conclusion. But part of this is you have to think they've already committed to this story so heavily. It's a part of this is saving face. They've just got to prove the story that they first came out with, I think, is that's part of it. As summer 2014 rolls around, the previously united front of Raphael and Amanda begins to falter. Raphael and his legal team change tactics. They distance themselves from Amanda's case and throw some doubt on her story. So up until now, it's kind of been Rudy on his own and Raphael and Amanda kind of being tried together and kind of going with a united thing of like, no, we didn't do this and we support each other kind of thing. In an interview, Raphael reveals that while Amanda did stay the night at his house, she returned to hers early and then came back unsettled. She told him that she had found blood in the bathroom and that she thought someone had broken in. However, instead of doing something regular like calling the police, she had taken a shower at the villa and then come back to Raphael's to get him, and then they both head back to the villa, then discover the body. He now says he found this strange.
Yeah, odd that this hasn't come up before, but I suppose if you're kind of like, if you think that the defense of your own innocence hinges on this person's innocence as well, then you wouldn't bring it up. But
so yeah,
that is odd. I will give him that. If that happened, that's very strange behavior.
He stops short of saying that Amanda murdered Meredith, but he tells CNN, "In my case, I really did nothing wrong, and I don't want to pay for someone else's peculiar behavior."
Defining murder as peculiar behavior is
I think he's saying if she's gonna go down for acting weird,
right,
even if she didn't do it,
okay,
I'm not going down based on her being weird,
right?
That's what he's saying, I think. And this is something that came up at trial with the prosecution saying Amanda took a long time to raise the alarm when she came back to the villa and supposedly found blood. She appears to have left and then returned with Raphael, which is kind of strange. If you think you've seen evidence for break-in, even if she hasn't seen the body at this point, she's just seen blood and a broken window. Maybe it's not that strange if you think you've just been broken in, but then blood...
Depends. That's definitely weird.
I think if I came back and I saw... Like, if I came back to my house and there was a window broken and I knew that my roommate lives here as well, I would look for her. I would be like, just to make sure she was okay.
Yeah, definitely.
He's only implicated because he's her alibi. His defense team is only doing their jobs right. They know they can strengthen his case by separating it from hers. On March 27th, 2015, after 8 years of legal battles, Italy's Supreme Court decides to overturn the convictions of Amanda Knox and Raphael. Their legal teams and families are obviously overjoyed. The Italian courts close the case of the murder of Meredith Kircher to the dismay of her family, who believe their daughter hasn't gotten proper justice. And that's fair, because even if these people didn't do it, why did you close the case if you overturned their convictions?
Like, it's become so removed from the actual, like, crime that's been committed at this point. It's like, it isn't even about Meredith anymore.
Exactly. To this day, the family despairs that they will probably never know what really happened that night. Unfortunately, as of 2015, Patrick Lumumba has not received any of his $54,000 from Amanda Knox for accusing him of murder. On November 23rd, 2021, Rudy, the only person who officially legally killed Meredith at this point, he was released from prison after serving 13 years. He was able to end his sentence early after being in partial release since 2017, taking part in community service and being assessed as, quote, socially well-integrated. Meredith's family and their legal team have stated that they believe the sentence was far too short considering what happened. Through his lawyer, Rudy stated that he wants to be, quote, forgotten by the world. During an interview after his release, Rudy stuck to his implication that Amanda was the ringleader in the attack and reiterated that she knows what happened. So make of that what you will. And earlier when I said, it was when they closed the case, I said that doesn't make sense. I mean, I guess you could argue it makes sense because Rudy's still in prison for the crime and someone's gone down for it. But it doesn't make sense because the story that you legally convicted him on is not what happened.
Yeah.
According to, saying
that these people aren't involved in it, then...
Then legally, like, what happened then? You still need to investigate. And that's why Meredith's family isn't happy with that outcome, because even if someone's in prison, they don't know what happened.
Yeah.
So that's an overview of everything, this triple trial mess of madness. I guess I'm wondering what you're thinking right now and what your attitudes are towards the people involved in this, what you think about the prosecution's version of events, etc.
I find the story, the sort of, it's some kind of satanic sex ritual, I find that hard to believe.
Hmm.
But as for the rest of it, I think there's not enough physical evidence to paint a clear story of what happened.
Hmm.
So it all rests on three people's memories or accounts of one night that have changed wildly across the course of the investigation. So none of them are particularly like trustworthy or believable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of just like anything could be true at this, yeah. Like, you know, there's not enough for me to feel a strong way either way about it. And like the physical evidence is like, okay, we have a knife with her DNA on it, the bra clasp with his, and some bloody handprints, which is like, okay, something is linking these three to this scene, but nothing is actually like a clear narrative of what happened isn't emerging.
I can relate to that interpretation. So Amanda Knox is still, in a sense, a public figure. She has talked about her experience in many forms of media. Regardless of whether you think she had a hand in the murder or not, it's very hard not to feel that her treatment by the media was unfair and sexist. And even before the trial began, she had to take legal action against a best-selling book published in Italy, which fictionalized the events of the case and yet presented them as if they were truth. Activity like this and the media representations would have made it incredibly hard for her to get a fair trial.
Yeah.
Obviously, in her home country of the US, there was a lot of support for Amanda, and a lot of experts from the US supported her in saying the forensics wasn't right and the trial wasn't fair. However, many, many people do think she was the killer.
Mm.
Like, many people at the public hate her and believe that she got away with murder. That's a viewpoint that's quite prominent still. And they believe she was the main instigator. She was mad at Meredith and things got violent. There was a strange sexual component to it. And you know that, you know, she was guilty, basically. That's a belief. A lot of people just found, whether this was the way she actually was, through her appearances, her public appearances and stuff, or whether it was the things they were reading about her, people found her unlikable. Mm. And simply, they didn't believe her because they didn't like her.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's just a human thing where we can't really see past our sort of personal judgments and look at actually the facts of a legal case.
Mm.
We just are like, well, I don't like her, so I don't believe her.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, Italy has been ordered to pay her compensation, and she's become an author, an activist against wrongful convictions. She's spoken at numerous events. She got married. She had her first child a couple of years ago. She used the proceeds from her book to help reimburse her family, who had gone into debt paying the legal fees from her trials.
Hmm.
I think the only thing you can say for sure in this case is that Rudy was there. He was there.
Right.
You know, he had a part in this incident.
No matter how active or passive he may have been in it, he was present.
Yeah, and the evidence putting Amanda and Raphael there is only, you know, that can be explained. But Rudy's, or you can try and explain it, but Rudy being there and his fingerprints and handprints being in blood there,
that's a lot harder to find some kind of ambiguity in.
The bloody fingerprints were everywhere. They were under her body as well.
Mm.
Like, there's no way this guy is innocent.
Yeah.
That's what we can say for sure. When you look into Rudy and stuff, you get the sense that he's a really maladjusted person. He's probably got mental health issues.
Right.
He's definitely dealt with substance abuse and stuff like that. And so it's not hard to make the argument that this was a break-in, rape and murder by Rudy alone.
Right.
And that does happen. It's not common. A stranger on stranger crime like that is very, like, in this environment, it's an extremely rare crime. So, but it does happen.
Because, so there was no, like, indication of them knowing each other prior to this, necessarily.
They had met... But they were not like friends or anything like that. Right. He was hanging around with some people that also knew people that lived in her villa.
Okay.
Like, there wasn't really a friendly connection, but they would have laid eyes on each other. And so maybe that would be the kind of, you know, he's seen her, he's interested.
Right.
So he's broken in and done this.
Which could be, it could support either version of it, of like, this is a consensual thing where they were mutually interested, or it's a one-sided preying on a vulnerable person.
Yeah, so it could be, you know, he's a disturbed guy who makes the acquaintance of this woman, knows where she lives, maybe hoped there was consensual feelings there at first.
Yeah.
And then maybe gets angry when she refuses, like, this is a thing that we know happens, that's more common. And especially when the perpetrator could be misinterpreting situations because of mental health issues or being disturbed in some other ways. So, he could be misinterpreting a situation and then become violent as a result of being rejected. But then I guess it's not exactly stranger on stranger crime in that way. But, you know, then experts did believe that more than one person was there. Rudy has served his sentence and is still saying Amanda was there. Like, he's out and he's still sort of saying that and committing to that. So you can't completely discount that. But again, he's not the most stable and reliable of dudes in any way. And some experts disagree, and some people who have, some forensic experts who've looked at the evidence, they say, yes, one guy could have done this. Like, it's not out of the realm of possibility at all for one person to do this, especially because she was restrained in the first instance.
Right.
And of course, it's been pointed out that this alliance of these three people, I mean, Amanda and Raphael together is one thing, but Amanda and Raphael and Rudy,
like, what ties the three of them together?
He's essentially a stranger to them.
Yeah.
And they then become in one night a group of three who kill together. It does seem really far-fetched.
So, that's true. Which is why the theory of the, like, cult ritual thing doesn't really hold up to me.
No. I mean, it's, to me, that's just a kind of media satanic panic type.
Yeah.
Like, it makes a juicy story, so we're going to write about it. But it doesn't seem compelling to me at all. This is one of those cases, again, that you could talk about for a long time. I know that there will be people listening to this who, like I said, will think, you didn't say this, you didn't talk about this.
Mm.
But again, not only is there not 6 hours for us to tear apart the details, but you wouldn't want to listen to 6 hours. Trust me. So that is the case of Meredith Kircher's murder and the many convictions and overturnings and convictions again that followed. And I would love to know what you think happened, what the audience thinks happened. So please do comment wherever you comment and wherever you comment, and let us know your thoughts and theories.
Mm. It is hard with cases like this where there's so much like conjecture and so little physical evidence to go off, where it's like many versions of these stories could be true to some degree, or they could be entirely made up.
Mm.
And it's kind of like, it really does boil down to, like, based on the very little evidence we have and a sort of personal feeling, as you were saying, like, you just feel a certain way and that's kind of what you build your beliefs around regarding this case.
Yeah, I think from my opinion on it would be like, I feel like I can only go on what can be factually proven. The only person that can be factually proven to have had a part in this is Rudy. He went to prison, in my opinion, for quite a short time for someone who's murdered someone, or, like, you know, been involved in a serious murder, like a very aggravated sexual assault as well.
Yeah.
That seems, I think his sentence seems short, even if you think he wasn't the only one. Like, I don't think, if you're in a group murdering situation, I don't think you should be sharing the sentences so you all get shorter sentences. You should all be getting a sentence, but that is reflects the magnitude of the crime. On the other hand, if he has, you know, he hasn't committed, as far as I know, he's not been convicted or even tried with any other kind of crime since this. And the finding was that he was ready to go back into society. And I haven't heard about him since then. So he's, I guess, within his, like, if the system worked and he's ready to return to society, then, like, who am I to say he should have been in prison longer? He should be in prison for as much time as it takes for him to be able to be in society without hurting other people.
Yeah.
But it does kind of, like, you know, in your tummy, you kind of feel like he should have been in there for a bit longer.
Yeah.
Just because for the family, it's going to feel like, what? That doesn't feel right. But yeah, I don't know. But yeah, and then when it comes to Amanda, like, and Raphael, I feel like I just find the story too far-fetched. Because Rudy has to be in the story.
Right.
You have to combine them with him somehow. And none of the ways that goes together gel for me.
Mm.
So, like, even if she seems really guilty, or if I think her behavior was weird, how do I put that together with this random guy that has to be there? Like, there's no question about that.
Mm.
So that's what doesn't work for me with trying to incorporate Amanda and Raphael into this crime. Like, I can't think of a story that makes sense. I guess it could be the one time ever that two people teamed up with a mentally ill drifter and killed their roommate. Like, yeah, I guess.
Well, unless, you know, Rudy's version of the story is that she was attacked and he came out and then handled the body and then freaked out because he knew he would be accused of it and
absconded left after that. I just don't buy that.
It does, I don't know, yeah.
But
it seems a bit unlikely. If you've got bloody handprints over a dead body, my first thought isn't, this is a completely innocent bystander who has, like, fled the scene of the crime.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't want to judge people based on their previous transgressions as well. Like, just because you're a thief and you've done, like, burglaries, that doesn't mean you're a rapist and a murderer. So I don't necessarily want to be like, well, he was a bad guy, so naturally he killed this person. But it does, it just doesn't, sorry, like, he did this in whatever capacity. It just happened. I can't get around that in my mind. I guess we don't know how mentally, like, malleable he could have been.
Yeah.
So considering his, like, that he's got some issues going on, like, could he have been completely taken advantage of
by these people? Well, that's the other thing.
It's possible.
The him adding the detail about Amanda once he hears that she was there is kind of like, either that's someone who's with it enough to know, like, oh, that's a thing I can add to my story that bolsters my innocence. Or it's someone who is so easily manipulated and so easily and readily creates false memories that the suggestion of someone else being there instantly creates a memory of that person being there.
Yeah.
And he is sure of that.
Yeah, because we don't really know the specifics of, like, what he's dealing with mentally. But that's that for that. So don't forget to subscribe, and that we are on social media. Follow us on Twitter at About Murder. Actually, don't do that, because I'm not using it anymore. Follow us on Instagram at A Podcast About Murder, facebook.com/A Podcast About Murder with no E, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Search channels for A Podcast About Murder. Please do like and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and give us a fantastic rating, of course. If you have any suggestions for the show, we're always open to those as well. You can even send us an email. It's apodcastaboutmurder@outlook.com. As always, have a great weekend.
Have a great weekend. Join us next week for the season finale.
Yes. I've forgotten what you're doing, so I'm excited.
So it'll be a surprise for everyone.
Yay. I love surprises.